I fear that a comment I made early this morning may mean I'm expected to go out and buy a pie for the current state staff here today. It is Pie Day, right? 314. The things we say that we come to regret. Actually, I wouldn't mind that at all, having been gone all last week and a couple of days from the week prior to that. Just to say thanks to the people moving around on our staff here to cover my absence. I do want to thank Scott Pohl and Kevin Lavery and Kyle Malin, who did a bang-up job, and Emmerich of Channel 10 and MSU's Sue Carter for filling in. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State here on WKAR. Back in 2014, voters here in Ingham County approved a millage proposal to support parks and trails. It's estimated that the millage is creating about $3.5 million annually for the operations of county parks. The plans have included trails in the Mason, Williamston, and Delhi Township areas, as well as near the Michigan State University campus. Since that vote, a county task force has been working on plans related to how and on what those dollars should be spent. Now, that task force is sending recommendations to the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. Our guests today on Current State are Kara Hope, who chairs the board. Welcome, Kara.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Terry Banas. Terry chaired the Parks Millage Task Force, and we're talking about the Parks Millage money and other issues. Welcome, Terry Banas.
Good morning, Mark.
Local governments will be asked to compete, essentially, for parks dollars. How is that going to work, Terry?
Well, just a little bit about the background. We, just last week, recommended a spending plan for trail improvements and maintenance in the coming couple of years.
And this is the task force.
This is the task force. Mm-hmm. And so what we are recommending needs to be voted on by the full Board of Commissioners. Now, we had eight members on our task force out of the 14, and it was a unanimous decision. All eight voted for it. So I feel that that kind of support is sort of a precursor of what the full board hopefully will do when they take action. We acted on a plan that provides $1 million for all recommended trail improvements across all systems. Now, the county doesn't own any particular municipal trails. It does own trails in its own county parks. But we have recommended spending up to $1 million in the first go around for improving every trail across all the municipalities that have them. And we had a big inventory done to identify mm-hmm. where those trails were.
And that includes the Lansing River Trail,
of course.
Where there is already some stretches that are in need of repair.
Right. And just for your listeners' information, we had consultants what took a while, 6 months, for this report to come together was our consultants did a full inventory of the entire system, all the conditions of all the trails, the conditions of all the bridges, and of the 84 sections of trails, 50 of them are in the Lansing River Trail, and those are all recommended in the first go-around for improvements. The other thing that we did was we recommended spending $4.5 million out of the money that we currently have. We've collected money from 2015 and 2016, and we've recommended that $4.5 million goes towards bridge repairs. Now, in the report, it cited that there were 12 bridges that needed total replacements, and we thought that given the money that we have collected so far, we would go a long way towards making a big impact on improving those most serious bridges.
Let's bring Kara Hope in here, though, because, I mean, you have been on the receiving end of some criticism for the grant process to assign about $1 million of this money. In yesterday's Lansing State Journal, Mayor Bernero called it divisive, but he's not the only critic, to be fair. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, full disclosure, I'm married to a critic. So Evan Hope, he's the Delhi Township clerk, and he was also quoted in the article on the
Indeed.
Trails. So I believe the criticism of the grant process, and I share the criticism, is that it pits communities against each other instead of taking a holistic approach.
This gets complicated, it seems, in part because of the river trail.
Right.
Go ahead and make your commentary.
What I wanted to say is that there are an estimated $20 million in needed improvements for all the bridges. Most of those are in Lansing. Another $1 million in improvement for trails. And that just counts, improving what's there now, not
right.
building on it. So we collect $3.5 million a year. We need a mechanism, a system for identifying, leveraging grant dollars and identifying project-ready projects that we could begin to move on. We don't have enough to cover it all today, tomorrow, or the next day. And the process that we've modeled ourselves after the DNR, which is, they have a pot of money that they distribute to communities that have projects. And we look at these projects in terms of, how important are they to the system? How important are they to the communities? Do they have support? Is there community support for them? Is there the potential to leverage other dollars? We need to make our dollars stretch. And we also have included certain policy issues. We have an equity position in our recommendations that says we will be fair-minded in offering these dollars to communities that haven't been represented and also to communities that are vulnerable.
It seems like you've got to walk a number of tight ropes here. You've
mm-hmm.
got to walk a tightrope between maintaining what's already out there and embarking on new trails, because I know embarking on new trails is a priority. It's a part of this framework as well.
It's not just a priority, but it's what the voters asked us to do. We have to follow the millage language. The millage language asked voters to approve a plan in which we would maintain and rehabilitate and expand the system. So we do have to walk a tightrope, or in my mind, it's a balancing act. It's improving what we have and expanding it. I said from the very beginning that this had to be a plan that we could eventually generate, that we would generate community support for across the county. Once we got going, once people started seeing that we were doing good things with these dollars, we would then, we would hope that people would renew the millage 5 years from now. And because what we have in terms of needs is more than we can do with a 6-year millage. This needs to continue. And I believe we have a good starting point.
Terry Banas is an Ingham County Commissioner. Kara Hope is also with us. She chairs the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. And we're talking about how to allocate money coming in as a result of voter approval of a Parks and Trails millage that was approved by voters back in 2012. Let's get back to the River Trail here, though, for just a second, because this is one factor that complicates this. It seems, since the River Trail is already a relatively big deal that covers miles already, it already requires maintenance, relatively a lot of maintenance, and there are already a lot more people in the city compared to many other parts of the county. It would seem the city has a pretty strong case for getting quite a bit of this money, or at least the money you would earmark for maintenance. Is that a fair assessment, do you think, Kara?
From my point of view, it is a fair assessment. And in fact, speaking of the language that was on the ballot, the Lansing River Trail was the only trail system that was mentioned by name. The purpose of the ballot language was to create and maintain a countywide system of trails, and the Lansing River Trail, with its 16 or 17 miles of trail, is the heart of the system. And if that heart of the system isn't healthy, then
right.
every section that connects to that Lansing River Trail will suffer from maybe less usage. It'll be looked at as less valuable.
Terry,
it was listed in the ballot language. It was listed as such as the commissioners. I was in the meeting. I wasn't on the commission at the time, but I was in the meeting when they adopted the language, and they said we need to give people an example of what a trail is that they might be familiar with. It was not meant to be exclusive. This was sold as a countywide trail system. And let me tell you about the dollars, because I mentioned that 50 out of the 84 sections of trails that were improving with that $1 million are in the city, that's more than 50% of the cost that we're willing to put into trail repairs right in the city. We recognize that the river trail is a central, important hub for this system, and nobody has been more outspoken about that on the task force than I have. I have said that we need to maintain our urban area. But let me tell you this. We have, of the bridges that we have allocated $4.5 million for, the five of those bridges are in the city. They amount to 83% of the total cost of the dollars that we are allocating.
At the same time, what do you say to people out county, though, who just feel way too much is going to the city?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think this is a fairly unique situation where the out county areas and Lansing are kind of in the same boat, in that the grant system that is proposed right now will favor communities that already have resources for trails. And Lansing's one of the communities that doesn't really have resources for trails right now. That's why there are so many pent up infrastructure needs.
I know one.
That's not true, actually, because we are encouraging communities to leverage grant dollars to bring to the table so that county dollars alone aren't used. But that will not be the only criteria for bumping up somebody's score in the way that we're going to be evaluating these applications.
I
did want to say that when, you know, it seems like a lot of criticism has come out, but let me tell you what the Lansing Friends of the River Trail are saying on their website. On their Facebook page. So they had 11 members at the meeting last Monday night. They were part of those who applauded after we took action. And on their Facebook page, they wrote, "Great turnout, and we were thrilled that the task force approved a plan that meets these critical needs." And what they were referring to in that post was both maintenance and expansion. They said they were thrilled. Also, in another post by the Friends group, too, they said good things are on the way. So I don't think that there's this widespread criticism. I think that there's fear. I think there's fear on the parts of some local officials, but I think we need to work together, and we can.
I'm remembering one comment from yesterday's State Journal treatment of this that involved, I believe it was Commissioner Randy Schaefer. And his comment was to the effect that, well, Lansing maybe needs to think twice about embarking on projects like the River Trail that they are not in a position to maintain themselves. What do you make of a comment like that, Kara?
Well, the Lansing River Trail is already there, and it doesn't make sense to let it deteriorate while we build new trails into the...
But it's a city resource. It's a resource that's associated with the city of Lansing.
It is city-owned. I would contend, and I think others would too, that it's an asset to the entire region, and that's the approach we should be taking with this allocation process, is to really look at it regionally and do the most with the taxpayer dollars that we can that will benefit the most people.
We want to thank
I just want to point out again. I just want to point out again, most of the money in the funds that we have today, a lion's share, a majority of the dollars are going to the city already. So these complaints that somehow the city is being shortchanged, they're just not true. And I think there's some strategy going on that's just beyond the facts that we have here.
Ingham County Commissioner Terry Banas has been our guest. We've also been joined by Kara Hope, chairperson of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners. We've been talking about how the county might spend money from the Parks and Trails millage proposed, which was approved by voters back in 2014. Sorry,
thank
we didn't
you.
Have time to get to other topics, but thank you both for
great.
Being here
thank you, Mark.
Today.
Thank you, Kara.
And coming up on Current State, 50 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court created the principle of one person, one vote. Now the High Court is considering a case that could change redistricting to reflect only people of voting age and not the total population. Coming up, we'll talk with Eric Lufer, president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. His group's been studying the potential impact of such a ruling in Michigan. That's on the way on Current State. Artists and artisans create glass all over the world, but East Lansing is home to a collection of hand-blown glass that is unique. Hebron glass originates in the Palestinian West Bank city of Hebron. It has an extremely colorful, swirled appearance. Not long ago, current state producer Katie Cook went to East Lansing Saper Galleries to see Roy Saper's collection. She first asked about the history of Hebron glass.
Hebron glass is remarkable in that it's an art medium that's been around for 2,000 years. And what's interesting and what distinguishes Hebron glass from so many other art forms and art media is it's all centered at one dot on the map, this large globe of ours. Hebron is a very large city, the largest city in the Palestinian West Bank territory, and it's mentioned the Bible dozens of times. And for 2,000 years, artisans there have been creating really unique glass using sand from the Dead Sea and with the addition of cobalt and other chemicals. And what I'm standing in front of right now is a large selection of this Hebron glass made in the same way that it's been made for millennia, but made by people obviously living today who are doing it in the same style and techniques as their ancestors. And what's remarkable at Hebron glass is, as you look at them, you'll see the style, the finishing, the detail. Every aspect of it is totally unique. They're compelling pieces. You want to hold them. You want to feel them. You want to look at them. And more importantly, I think you want to share them because they are so unique.
Describe for our listeners a little bit more what it looks like. I would describe the coloring as like a marbled effect.
Excellent, like a swirl, almost like those of us who are a little bit over the 30, 40, or 50 age range. We had little marbles we played with when we were children, little round balls that were maybe 5/8 of an inch in diameter up to an inch, and we'd flick them with our thumb, and those had a swirl design in them. The swirl design of those marbles is somewhat similar, though not as unique, as the Hebron glass swirl. So it looks like kind of like a marbled effect if you were baking a cake and you were marbling the frosting or the cake. There's purple and there are greens, and then there's a rich cobalt blue. And when these are backlit or there's light underneath, they have a transparency that's outstanding. This bright amber just glows. And there's a swirl design that's made by the artist who's creating this using this molten taffy-like glass that's brought out of a furnace on the end of this long, hollow metal tube. It's remarkable how they achieve this exacting technique and style. But what's truly remarkable is that you only see it in Hebron glass. And if you think there have to be thousands of glass blowers around the world, this style of this colorful, swirled glass that feels like there's motion in it, it feels alive, it feels organic, you only find this style, this technique from this dot on the map, Hebron, in the Palestinian West Bank. And I'll tell you, I heard about this. I've always known about Hebron glass. And I thought, you know, I'm going to that part of the world. And I'm thinking, I've got to stop there. How could you go halfway around the world and be so close and not go there? So I had that obligation. I needed to go see it.
I was wondering if you knew about the glass before you went to Hebron or if you discovered it when you were there on a trip.
Excellent.
So how did that happen?
Question. Well, a lot of the items we have here, the hand-painted boxes from Brazil and the coca-bola wood boxes and bowls that I found in Costa Rica, a lot of the items I've found in travels I've come across as a total discovery. But this is one of the rare cases where I knew about it, but I've never really seen Hebron glass. And so what I did is I went to Hebron after going to the Middle East, the Palestine area, to pick up one of my sons who was doing an internship there at a non-governmental organization. So my son and my wife and I got in a car, and I was in Israel, and I found what I'm told was the only car that I could drive from Israel into the West Bank without it being problem or difficulty. It had an Israeli license plate. And I remember the first time I drove this car in when the rocks started flying because of an Israeli license plate and I was in Arab country, I realized this was a difficulty. But the most exciting thing was when I discovered this workshop, and I went in and I saw shells of this long-lost, not well-known Hebron glass there. I could feel my heart. I'm thinking, this is like a discovery. This is like an amazing discovery, because I knew that it would be very rare to find this glass in America. And I made it a commitment at that time to bring a very significant large collection of Hebron glass back to America, back to Michigan, so I'd be able to share it with those who enjoy discoveries as I do.
I'm here at Saper Galleries in East Lansing speaking with the owner, Roy Saper, about their extensive collection of Hebron glass. In fact, it's the largest collection in the world outside the Middle East. So you had some trouble bringing that large amount of glass back to the States, is that right?
Katie, it is a little almost amusing, but now in retrospect. But I said to the packers as they were packing up the several dozen Hebron glass vases, vessels, pitchers, and decanters that I selected, I said, pack them up, I'll come back in a couple hours and I'll take them. And they gave me a look that said, Roy, you don't know what you're talking about. This is the Palestinian West Bank. And to get out of the Palestinian West Bank, one has to go into Israel. And at the checkpoints, they won't let you through with these boxes, because Israel is protective of its country and doesn't want anything in its country that could be harmful or put the citizens of the state of Israel at risk. So my family, one son, and my wife left Hebron without these boxes, and I was told they were going to be shipped to us. But when we were at a checkpoint, my wife and I were separated from our sons not because of the Hebron glass, but because someone had given as a gift to my son a book. That book was the Quran. And as soon as my son acknowledged it was his, more armed forces came out, so we were surrounded. They took my wife and I, and they put us in a metal holding cell, and they detained us for 3 or 4 hours. They would ask my son a bunch of questions, and then the interrogators would come to us and ask us questions. And I remember at one point they're bringing some other Arabs into the prison, and they looked at us and they looked at the guards and they asked the guards, what are you doing? They're Americans. They are funding your whole operation. Let them out of here. But the Israeli Defense Forces, they go through all the motions to ensure that their country or their state is not put at risk. So it was a difficult situation. I'd encourage others to do a little search and learn more about Hebron and the West Bank to see that the freedoms that we enjoy here in America and Michigan are such a contrast to what is in many parts of the world.
This collection of glass is available to be viewed year-round, is that right?
Yes, our intent is to always have them. We welcome people to come and visit and enjoy them directly.
Roy Saper there, owner of East Lansing Saper Galleries, talking about his collection of Hebron glass with Current State producer Katie Cook. Coming up on Current State, it can be tough to change someone's mind, and even harder to overcome your own prejudices. That's what Hazlitt Public Schools teacher Ben Pineda found out. He had his own change of heart story to tell at our most recent Pop-Up Stories event. You will hear Ben's story coming up after the break on Current State. Your thoughts about Current State are always encouraged. Do you like what we do? Do you have suggestions? Make some corrections. We're all ears at currentstate@wkar.org. That's currentstate@wkar.org. Heck, you can even call me, Mark Bayshore, directly at 517-884-4776. Michigan, like every state in the country, divides its population into legislative districts. These boundaries are designed to congregate about the same number of people into each district to ensure equal political representation. The Michigan legislature draws the state's House and Senate districts based on census data, acquired every 10 years, congressional districts are created in the same way. A case now before the U.S. Supreme Court could change all that. At issue is whether legislative districts should be drawn according to the total population, as it now stands, or based only on persons of voting age. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan has been studying the possible effects of just such a redistricting change here in Michigan. Joining me now to talk about it is President of the CRC, Eric Lufer. Eric, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you for having me back.
This issue stems from a U.S. Supreme Court case that originated in Texas, and it was argued back in December, Evenwell versus Abbott. What's exactly at the heart of this discussion?
Well, I think the heart of the discussion is something unique to Texas and many of our southern states that we experience to minor effects here in Michigan, but not nearly to the same extent they do down there. They have large numbers of immigrants, some legal, some illegal. And when they drew the lines and put these people that are challenging this into districts with a large number of people who can't vote, they felt that their representation, their ability to affect policy change mm-hmm. was being unfairly affected. And so they challenged this, and they haven't had much luck, but they did push it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Indeed, it's gone all the way to the top, as it were, here. If the Supreme Court does overturn the Fifth Circuit ruling, and it does allow what's the acronym here is CVAP, Citizen Voting Age Population, CVAP. What kind of impact would we see if the High Court overturned the Fifth Circuit ruling?
So that was kind of the root of why we wanted to look into this. We weren't making any value judgment that this was worth change or not, but this is something that clearly would affect representation. Stands, as you said, to affect every state in the nation. So we dug into it, and what we found is that while Michigan has a population of about 9.9 million people, its citizens of voting age population is about 7.7 million people. So clearly a subgroup of our overall population. And to be clear, when we talk about citizens of voting age population, this is kind of a surrogate measure for what they're trying to get at. To be a citizen, you have to be at least 18 years of age. You have to either be a naturalized citizen or have gone through and become a citizen. And so there, you also take out the people who have been incarcerated and aren't eligible to vote. So you weed out a number of people, the young and the immigrants, things like that. So you get to this smaller population, about 7.7 million people, and then when you start looking at where they are throughout the state, it doesn't vary to a great extent from our current districts, the way they've drawn them to try to create as equal representation as possible. But there are some districts where there is significant variance, and what we found by looking at this is in order to fix those few districts that are far off, you're going to affect either all districts or a great majority of the districts, because in order to grow one, you have to borrow from another.
Exactly.
To shrink one, you have to expand another. It's kind of the population. If it expands, something else it has to give to allow it to expand.
It's interesting, though, because one of the few districts that would be notably impacted is our very own here, as I sit here in East Lansing, the 69th House District, that Sam Singh's district. Sam is the House Democratic floor leader. What's happening in the 69th? What would happen in the 69th? And what is it about the demographics of our district that's relevant here?
So we didn't dig into great extent, but I think given what we know about East Lansing, having the university there, having populations from other places coming to attend Michigan State University, we know that they're usually coming legal ways, but they're usually not, or you know, then they're still not eligible to vote. So the district would have to contract to, it would have to expand some to pick up more population so that there's a greater number of citizens of voting age population to
right.
equalize that. And I think what's common here with some of the others that we found is these districts tend to be in the urban areas of our state, in Detroit, in Oakland County, in Lansing area, in the Grand Rapids and Muskegon area. There's a commonality there. And so East Lansing kind of stands out as being unique for the reason having the university there. I think in the other places, there's a number of other reasons we can look at.
What about Michigan's 14 congressional districts here? Would you see any significant change to our seats in Congress?
What we see there, while the legislative districts are drawn to be close to a target, they pretty much nailed it with our congressional districts. There's zero difference from the target as of 2010 when they drew these lines. So by going to this different measure, you're going to have difference from the target. The greatest difference is about 4.5%. And so that may or may not fit into a level that's equitable that they're willing to live with. But every district, every congressional district would be affected in one way or another if they tried to get that back to zero variance.
We're talking about a case before the U.S. Supreme Court that would potentially change the way voting districts are drawn across the country, and it could mean Michigan would have to recalculate its districting system to reflect the voting age population rather than the total population. Eric Lufers with the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, which has recently written a study on the issue. Virtually all of us understand what gerrymandering is. We learned the term back in school. It refers, of course, to manipulating a district's boundaries to favor one political party over another. Would a rule change be a deterrent to gerrymandering? How would those be connected?
No, we don't think it'd be connected, that you're still able to draw the lines to favor one party or another with this ruling. What this would do, I think it would have some minor effect on which parties are being represented and maybe make it a little more difficult because there is such a concentration of these districts in our urban areas. So the overall effect, I think, is negligible in doing anything about gerrymandering.
Did the support and resistance to this become apparent to you? Were there patterns that emerged as far as who supports a move like this and who opposes a measure like this?
That's a little beyond the scope of our study, but we did notice that when we were doing the research. And because these urban areas are the most affected, the question of representation, it tends to be the Democratic Party that's in these districts for the most part.
Okay.
So they've tended to defend the status quo, and it's the Republican Party that's pushed this down in Texas. I don't want to extend that the Republican Party everywhere is feeling this way. So that's what we found.
Understood. Okay. Eric Lufer is president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. We have been talking about CRC's report, which studies the potential impact of a pending U.S. Supreme Court decision that would impact redistricting here in Michigan. Eric, we'll have to watch and see what comes from the High Court. We thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. It can be tough to change someone's mind and even harder to overcome your own prejudices. So when it happens, it's usually a pretty good story. Here's Hazlitt Public Schools teacher Ben Pineda talking about his change of heart at Current State's Pop-Up Stories event a few weeks ago.
So in 1983, I graduated from Adrian High School and came to Michigan State University, and I really haven't left since, right? And when I came up to Michigan State University, I loved Michigan State. I love Michigan State. I bleed green and white. Lansing, not so much. And I got to know Lansing pretty well as a undergrad at Michigan State, because I would get on my bike and I would ride out to neighborhoods where rivers were, aka the Grand River and the Red Cedar, and I would fish. I'd fish for carp, I'd fish for catfish, I'd fish for pike. And I saw Lansing in a not so very good light. I saw Lansing where red light and drug deals were kind of everywhere. So I was always happy to get back to Michigan State, always happy to get back to Snyder Phillips and the comforts of East Lansing. So when I graduated from MSU, I became a teacher. And that's what I am. I am a public school teacher. I teach 8th grade social studies. This is my 25th year at Hazlitt Middle School. This is my 28th total. And one of the things that is really awesome about being a teacher, snow days, right? And in 1991, pretty early in my teaching career, I was about to experience the very first day off of school, not because of snow, but because of cold. It was so cold, school was canceled the next day. We found out like in the afternoon, and it was like in the negative 20s. And I thought to myself, yeah, no school, and we know a lot farther in advance than just the morning of. And so how do I celebrate? Pizza tonight. And on South Washington, there was a Little Caesars, which no longer is there. It's about, it used to be maybe an eighth of a mile south of where the Board of Water and Light facility is there now. And if you guys remember back in the day, Little Caesars had this promotion called Pizza Pizza. Yeah. One price and you get two pizzas, right? And so here I am on this frigid night in the minus 20 below zero, and I go to get my Pizza Pizza. And they had this other promotion where you get a free crazy bread as well. And so I'm like, this is good. So I come out, and you got to remember, this is the weather where you breathe and your nostrils freeze, right? We've all been there, because we're in Michigan. And as I'm walking to my car, I see something out of my peripheral. And it kind of startles me. And I look, and there's this guy, a tattered man, layered, but tattered. And he doesn't have any legs. And he looks very homeless and very tattered. And he comes up to me in a wheelchair. And I remember his demeanor was not, was could be described as basically rude. And he comes up, and he's like, hey, hey, hey. And I'm like, yeah? And I really kind of took me. I was a little startled. And he's like, well, and he paused. And I'm like, you okay? And he's like, well, I need some help. And he kind of said it like that. Yeah? What can I do for you? Well, I'm hungry. And so, taken with the moment, here's the crazy bread. So I gave him the crazy bread. And from that, maybe a thank you? I don't think so. He turned around and was on his way down that frozen parking lot. And I'm looking at him. And I'm like, whoa, hey, where are you going? And he turns around and he says to me, I got a spot under the Shiawassee Bridge tonight. You're staying outside tonight? Yeah. And he looked at me like, duh. Isn't there a place you can go, like a shelter or something? And he's like, yeah, I got there. But you know what? I got there too late today. They were full. They're full? And he looked at me and he says, they fill up every night. And off he disappeared into the darkness. And at that moment, something changed for me. They fill up every night in a medium-sized town like Lansing that I've only seen through the eyes of a red light district or a drug deal on the corner, feeling so safe in the river. And I realized, this is a city that because it has services like the City Rescue Mission, like the VOA, like Loaves and Fishes, services its community so we don't have homeless people running around like we do in other cities. You don't see that many in Lansing, do you? You know why? Because this community takes care of this community. And it changed for me. And I started to see changes. Rio Town, look at it now. What we call the Stadium District, which used to be probably the seediest area, look at it now. And here we are in Old Town. Look at Old Town. Fishing for walleye at 2 a.m. in that Branky Fish Ladder. I was so happy to be in the river because what was happening out here in the late 80s and early 90s was pretty yucky stuff. And look at Old Town now. I got to tell you, I think Lansing has got an awesome case for being one of the most, if not the most improved city in the United States. And you know what? I love Lansing. And I have never left since. Thank you very much.
And we've got another pop-up stories event coming soon. Join us at the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing, Thursday the 24th, 6 p.m. for stories on the theme, Lucky Break. Lucky Break. If you want to tell your own story, please email us, currentstate@wkar.org. You can also stay up to date on all of our upcoming events by liking our Facebook page at Pop-Up Stories Lansing. It's Current State on WKAR. Although the Michigan State Spartans fell just short of a regular season Big Ten championship in 2016, they came up big in Indy this weekend, and Current Sports host Al Martin was there. What a weekend.
What a weekend.
Pair of games.
Yeah, crazy games. I'm still wiping the crust out my eyes, Mark, from the drive last night. But, man, riding high from the excitement. Gotta love March.
What do these two victories over Purdue and Maryland mean, pointing ahead to the big dance?
Well, one, I think, Mark, this team is peaking right now. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And as I mentioned, I mean, this team can handle adversity. That's the biggest takeaway for me when looking at what took place this weekend, specifically against Maryland and Purdue. When things got tight down the stretch of both of those games, Michigan State did not fold, Mark. And you saw other players step up other than, of course, your usual suspects. Mm-hmm. Denzel Valentine did what Denzel Valentine does. I mean, 15 points, 10 rebounds, 9 assists against Purdue. The game prior to that, 18 points, 10 assists, 7 rebounds against Maryland. Really flirting with a triple-double. Then the game before that, Ohio State, 19 points, 8 assists, 9 boards. But it's the other players that stepped up that really shows how this team has matured over time, Mark.
Name one for us.
Against Purdue, I mean, looking at these names, get this. Gavin Schilling, Marvin Clark, Colby Wolliman, who was huge, Matt McQuaid, Tum Tum Nairn Jr., Alvin Ellis, all guys on the bench that chipped in other than the game starters. Mm-hmm. That's called depth. And that's something I've said about this Michigan State team all year. They can legitimately go, Mark, 15 deep on the squad. And that's so impressive. And then going against a team like Purdue that, of course, they have the Twin Towers down low in Caleb Swanigan, Isaac Haas, and A.J. Hammonds, we saw players like Colby Wolinman and Matt Costello, the bigs of Michigan State, step up. It was really surprising to me that, you know, you look at that loss that Michigan State had to Purdue earlier in the year, in which they lost by 1 point in overtime. Mm-hmm. Michigan State out-rebounded Purdue. They out-rebounded those bigs by 10, 41 and 31 rebounding advantage. So takeaway from the weekend, this team in crunch time can deliver even without, again, their starting shooter, Bryn Forbes, not lighting it up from deep as well.
Some are seeing MSU's number 2 seed in the Midwest bracket as something of a slight. What do you make of it?
I agree with it. I can't hold you up, Mark. Michigan State not being a number 1 seed really was one of the big surprises when that bracket came out last night. Seeing as though Virginia is a number 1 seed, mm-hmm. and Virginia failed to win the ACC regular season title and failed to win the ACC regular season tournament. You know, end of season tournament, I should say, over the weekend, which is so crazy to me. I don't know if there's ever been a number one seed that hasn't won their respective regular season conference title and not won their also conference tourney title at that. So that's surprising. MSU had an 8 RPI. They had, top 50 wins. They won, 15 of their last 14 games. Virginia had glaring losses to teams like George Washington, V-Tech, Georgia Tech, Florida State, Miami. And I think the general consensus mindset for Michigan State was that if they at least got to the semifinals, Mark, they deserved to be a number one seed, let alone win the entire Big Ten tournament. So it was surprising. Talk to Izzo and other personnel of the team, and that was the big storyline. Do you guys feel slighted that you aren't a number one seed? And they all felt, you know, gave the cliche answer that, you know, we don't care. We'll play anybody. Right. We don't care. It is what it is. That's the committee.
Now, others, some are saying that Virginia, who MSU defeated in last year's tournament,
exactly,
too, by the way,
right,
would trade that seed for the chance to avoid facing Michigan State again.
I think we're grasping at straws on that one, Mark. I think that Virginia, I mean, any team who, especially a Virginia, they know that Michigan State took them out the tourney last year. I don't think they want to avoid Michigan State. Would it be an easier path if Michigan State wasn't in their bracket? Of course, because Michigan State right now, according to many people, is a big favorite to win this whole thing. But Virginia remembers what took place last year. A 60-54 loss in the East region that propelled Michigan State to the Sweet 16. We all know how, at the time, Travis Trice just went completely off. He threw up 23 points and scored 13 of the first 15 points for Michigan State, mm-hmm, in that game. Virginia, they remember that. They want a bit of revenge in that game. So I would argue otherwise, the complete opposite of that notion, Mark.
Is MSU in the best bracket to stay on track to the Final Four?
Is
that the reward, in a sense, for not getting the number one seed?
Playing in the Midwest region, Mark,
sure,
when you compare it to the other three regions, I think it is the easier path. If Michigan State is going to get to a Final Four, and seeing as though, you know, when things are said and done in the Midwest region, I mean, you're playing in Chicago, which isn't far from Michigan. I tell you what, if they make it to Chicago, much of that stadium is going to be green and white. So without a doubt, I mean, you look at the other regions out there, they're not playing. They don't have to go against a Kentucky. You know what I mean? They don't have to go against Kansas unless they make it to the final, well, the national championship game. So, yes, I do believe that this region is the easiest path for Michigan State to get there, but they can't take any team for granted because there is so much parity in this year of college basketball, Mark.
What raised an eyebrow for you on the selection show here? Any surprising inclusions or any surprising omissions?
Well, again, I can go back to Michigan State not being a number one seed, but, you know, Oregon and Virginia as number one seeds, while MSU is not. Again, I keep harping on that because it was so glaring. It was so glaring. And looking at, you know, the statement that Oklahoma athletic director Joe Castiglione, that he said, you know, as to why Michigan State wasn't a number one seed, he talked about Oregon's, you know, third rated strength of schedule and number two RPI and kind of harped on the same when it comes to Virginia. But he said it was a very tough decision. It was an argument that was happening when concerning Michigan State being a number one seed. And also, you know, this is good. It's so difficult around this time of the year because there isn't like a Kentucky of last year where Kentucky entered the tournament last year undefeated. There is not that one juggernaut that you can clearly look at has the best chance to win this whole thing. Get this, Mark. A glaring stat, looking at the weekend when it comes to the postseason tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
Out of 31 postseason tournaments this past weekend, only 10 of them, only 10, were won by top seeds. That's it. That's a glaring stat that shows that anybody can win this thing this year. You thought your bracket was in the trash after the first weekend? You might as well throw it away right now, Mark, before you even get started, all right?
Interesting to think, too. Seeing the Oklahoma official here, Joe Castiglione.
Right.
Next year, that'll be Mark Hollis.
Isn't it
up
something?
Up there on CBS on the selection program. You made a point, though, here that, I mean, Denzel Valentine is seen often as the quote, franchise player here for the Spartans, but you made a powerful case here for the importance of depth on this team. Which would you say is more important in the postseason, the depth or that Denzel really do well?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question. I would say depth, Mark, because at some point, these teams know that Denzel Valentine is going to be a catalyst, and they're going to start to hone in on him. You're going to start to see teams key in on him and double-team him. Will his teammates step up in those moments is a big question that a lot of teams don't have the luxury in feeling confident in saying yes. And another thing, though, Bryn Forbes, again, a guy who I believe is the best shooter in college basketball, and he's also another stud for this team, but what's also telling for this team that speaks to that depth, Mark, is that Bryn Forbes, he didn't shoot lights out. He had 9 points, 1 of 6 from the three-point line against Purdue, 4 points, 0 of 4 from the three-point line in the game prior to that against Maryland. But at the same time, his teammates stepped up. And again, give a lot of credit to Kobe Wolliman last night. How fantastic was he yesterday afternoon? 4 points, five rebounds,
really
one
assist. Really noticeable. I was really happy for him.
Oh, boy, he was great. And a great defensive effort against the bigs down low for him as well. So I think depth is more important to answer your question, Mark.
More from WKAR current sports host Al Martin every weekday at 1 p.m. on AM 870 WKAR. Current sports on WKAR-TV returns after a brief hiatus next Thursday evening, the 24th at 10 p.m. Al Martin, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mark.
And that's our program for today. Tomorrow on Current State, the Ann Arbor Film Festival is the longest-running independent experimental film festival in the U.S. We'll speak with the fest's executive director about how to spend a week in downtown Ann Arbor taking in all those films. Plus, Lapeer-based author William Anderson has written extensively about Laura Ingalls Wilder. His latest title is The Selected Works of Laura Ingalls Wilder. He talks with Scott Pohl about the project ahead of two Michigan bookstore appearances here this week. That and more all coming up Tuesday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Labrie directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Connect with us on social media. On Twitter, we're at KAR Current State. That's at KAR Current State. On Facebook, it's Current State from WKAR. Hope you have a great day. We'll be looking for you tomorrow. Current State on WKAR.